miles an hour, spraying a vacant lot 50 feet below with pieces of concrete and twisted metal. The remaining pack, including the silver BMW, roared through the new gap in the wall and tumbled end over end through the air, smashing down on top of one another in a fiery wreck. The video feed turned to snow. Done. Greg took a deep breath and felt himself coming down off the adrenaline surge. He could imagine the police stopping to look out over a tangled pile of burning wreckage, scratching their heads, as police are wont to do. It would take them days to figure out. The nearest police car GPS signal was a mile away. He did a quick post-mortem. The demon task force had been neutralized. It might mean another level for him. A motorcycle streaked up alongside his car. The rider reached out with one hand, extending a submachine gun, and fired a short burst at Greg's tires.
What the hell?
Greg raised his gloved hands to fire the Nova light, but then realized his blacked-out windows would ruin the effect. His armored windows didn't roll down either.
Son of a bitch!
Greg motioned with his gloved hand and swerved the car toward the racing bike. But the bike was far more maneuverable. It ducked around to the right side of the car. Again, automatic gunfire cracked at his tires. Greg shook his head.
Solid rubber, asshole.
He reached out into D-space and started drawing from the surrounding horde, pulling dozens of remaining automates toward him.
You want to play? Then let's play.
Ross and a Corps lieutenant peered through the recessed postern gate. Dozens of automates crisscrossed the tarmac, circling Building 29. Ross looked across the barren tarmac leading to the ship channel 100 yards away. It was the longest 100 yards he'd ever seen. Philip sat in the corridor with several more Corps guards. A medic wound a bandage around her head to cover her injured eyes, while the others trained weapons on the short corridor behind them. Phillips looked up blindly.
What's the situation?
Ross and the lieutenant slammed the door with a clang and turned to face her. A roaring motorcycle engine, gunshots, and screams echoed through the interior halls. A guard stared down the corridor.
We can't stay here, sirs.
We need to run for it, Nat. Those Razorbacks appear to know the floor plan. They're methodically clearing rooms.
The lieutenant piped in.
They're armored, Doctor. Light weapons don't stop them. At least not from the front.
She nodded gravely.
There's a ship channel about 100 yards away. If we can reach that, we should be safe.
Ross turned to the lieutenant and pointed toward what appeared to be dynamite sticks snugged into his web harness.
What are those?
The man glanced down.
Magnesium flares, to signal the medevac chopper. The radio was down for...
Break 'em out. These automates probably target with infrared. Flares could distract them.
The lieutenant pulled out 6 flares. He handed 3 to Ross.
Just twist the top off and strike them, like this.
He pantomimed the action.
Let's test this.
Ross struck the flare several times before it ignited. He held it, hissing and popping in the corridor. It burned a brilliant red.
Open the door!
One guard heaved the heavy steel door open, and Ross hurled the flare as far as he could off to the right. He and several guards watched closely as an automate swerved to avoid it. Another swung wide around it. The lieutenant frowned.
So much for the infrared theory.
Phillips looked toward his voice. What's happening?
Ross shook his head.
They're not attracted to the flares, Nat. They're avoiding them.
Then they are using infrared. They're looking for human heat signatures. The flares must look like a raging fire.
Ross and the lieutenant exchanged looks. Ross nodded and knelt next to her.
You're right. We're in business, Nat.
He removed his jacket and placed one empty sleeve in her hand, then grabbed the other one.
Don't let go of this. I'll guide you. We'll use the flares to conceal our human heat signature. The tarmac is flat. Just follow me and move as fast as you can.
How many automates are there?
You don't want to know.
John, I...
Her head darted to follow a roaring engine as it passed.
I know it sucks you can't see. We'll get you to a hospital, but we need to do this to have any chance at all. Just run with me. You ready?
She reluctantly nodded. Ross turned to the Corps lieutenant.
You and your men ready, Lieutenant?
A motorcycle engine revved and screams echoed behind them, punctuating his words.
Klauski, distribute these.
He passed the magnesium flares.
We travel in a group. Place these on our perimeter.
The guards struck flares. Ross lit one for himself. Finally, the six of them stood there with five lit flares. Ross pulled in front of the lieutenant with Phillips in tow and looked out at the stream of automates racing past, waiting for a gap.
Okay. Now!
They bolted from the recessed doorway as a group and moved quickly across the tarmac like deer running across a freeway. The lieutenant barked,
Close it up!
The nearest automates immediately screeched around and vectored toward them. The lieutenant threw out his arm.
Stop moving! Stop!
They all stopped, and the automate turned slightly aside, then roared past 60 feet to their left. The group stood back to back on the tarmac, flares hissing and automates racing past them. Ross shook his head.
Bad news, Nat. They're apparently attracted to lateral movement as well.
She nodded behind her blindfold.
Fires don't generally run around. I should have guessed Sobel would have more than one criterion.
The lieutenant pounded his helmeted forehead with his hand.
Hell of a time to realize that. Just fucking beautiful.
He looked back at the postern gate, already 70 feet behind them. Ross's gaze followed a sedan racing past 20 feet away.
Okay, let's try this. Let's move slowly toward the water.
The lieutenant shook his head.
Back toward the postern gate.
Phillips turned to him.
John's right. We can't head back toward the Razorbacks. These automates must have a threshold of movement detection. We move slowly.
The lieutenant gave Ross a venomous look since he was serving as Phillips' eyes. He then finally nodded.
All right, Doctor.
They all slid their feet across the tarmac as automates raced past doing loops around the building. They seemed to be coming closer with each pass, but the group of evacuees managed to traverse another 150 feet. The water's edge was tantalizingly close. A guard tapped Ross on the shoulder.
Hey! Hey, this side! Look out!
Ross turned to see a Dodge easing to a stop 50 feet away, facing them. Other automates still raced past. Phillips turned toward it.
What is it?
That Dodge is getting suspicious.
She nodded.
John, you think it's referencing our location on a grid?
He considered this.
You mean tracking targets over time instead of...
Enough!
The lieutenant pointed.
We've got incoming!
Another sedan vectored toward them while the Dodge seemed to observe. The second car was accelerating fast. The lieutenant shook his head.
Fuck this! Run for the waterline!
Ross grabbed his arm.
It could be testing us. Stand still!
The lieutenant pulled free. He and his men sprinted in a ragged line toward the jetty, opening fire on the cars as they ran. The moment they did so, the incoming car targeted them, and the nearby Dodge accelerated past Ross and Phillips, also giving chase. She cringed as it streaked past just feet to her left.
John, what's happening?
He pulled her close. Wait, Nat.
He saw three more cars racing in, one headed toward he and Phillips. Ross hurled the flare in its direction and then tugged on the jacket sleeve.
Run! Now!
The lieutenant fired at another incoming car as he sprinted toward the waterline. But the first sedan overtook him, tossing his body up over its hood, smashing him into its windshield, then up over the roof. He flipped three times, then landed on the pavement just in time for the Dodge to gore him. His body jammed in its undercarriage and was dragged away. The other men scattered as automates ran them down. Sporadic gunfire was quickly replaced by the shrieks of injured men, crawling toward safety as the cars circled back for the kill. Phillips glanced back reflexively.
What's happening?
Just run!
He led Phillips on a different, longer tack to the shoreline, away from the feeding frenzy of the automates. He and Phillips were nearly at the water. Another car roared up behind them. Ross pulled hard on the jacket sleeve. They had reached the jetty stones.
Jump!
He could see her grit her teeth, going on blind faith in him. They arced out into the air, splashing into the freezing water as the car hurtled inches over their heads. It landed 10 feet beyond them and sent up a splash wall 30 feet high. Ross and Phillips both came up flapping their arms, Phillips coughing up water. Ross grabbed her around the neck from behind and swam toward the jetty stones again as the tail of the bobbing sedan settled back into the water, nearly coming down on her head. It flopped onto the waves, bubbling and hissing around them. She sensed that something large had just missed her.
John!
It's okay. Wait. It's sinking.
Where are the others?
They're gone. She panted as they bobbed there for several seconds, listening to bubbling water and distant engines on the tarmac above, his arms still around her. Soon, there was just hissing. Okay, swim. Follow my voice. Merritt cradled the UMP on the bike's broad gas tank and swerved from side to side, trying to get around Loki's BMW. Each time he approached, Loki stabbed on the brakes. Finally, the road widened again. The corrugated fences of salvage yards and aging factories now fronted it. Merritt accelerated rapidly, roaring alongside the car. He searched for some weakness in the armor and noticed brushed steel knobs appeared at regular intervals on the roof, hood, and trunk. They looked like high-end cell phone antennas, a dozen of them evenly spaced. Merritt braked and swerved as Loki tried to smash him into a line of parked cars. Merritt accelerated around the other side and lifted up the UMP. He glanced at the road, then took careful aim at the car. He fired a short burst. The shots ricocheted off the roof. Loki swerved toward him again, and instead of dodging away immediately, Merritt let him come closer. He took more careful aim and fired again, nailing a metal knob and barely denting it. Son of a bitch! Behind Merritt, 8 sedans screeched in from side streets. He glanced back over his shoulder to see them surging after him. He raised the UMP one-handed and opened up with short, controlled bursts. The front tires of the first one, then another, blasted out, and they quickly fell behind as the others accelerated. He knocked out the tires on still a third. The gun was empty. Merritt turned forward and saw 10 more unmanned cars come in from the side streets up ahead. No way to reload. Time to concentrate. He tossed the UMP onto the hood of a nearby car, then ripped the throttle and drove howling past Loki. Merritt dodged a hatchback emerging from a parking lot, which turned out to be a regular car with people in it. An onrushing automate immediately broadsided it. Half a dozen more automates streamed in from side streets behind him. Merritt turned forward again to see the automates approaching up ahead, surging his way in interlocking slaloms. It was an impenetrable roving barrier, a demonstration of networked swarming behavior that no human drivers could match. Merritt had a couple of seconds at most. A score of automates were all around him, closing fast, more coming in every second. He looked back at Loki's BMW, then swerved and stabbed the brakes, bringing himself just feet off Loki's front bumper. Still going 70, he eased back on the throttle and, taking a breath, released his hold on the handlebars, falling backward onto Loki's front hood as the BMW bumped his bike's rear tire. The bike veered forward and to the side and was immediately crushed by a wall of oncoming automates, which raced past only inches to either side of the BMW. Several smashed head-on into pursuing automates, exploding into a whirlwind of plastic parts, glass, and tumbling metal. Merritt hit Loki's hood hard, then slid back into the windshield. He rolled left, jamming his foot down onto a brushed metal knob at the corner of the hood, and clamped on to the wiper well with his hands. He braced his other foot against the knob on the far corner like a rock-climbing wall. He glared into the blacked-out windshield and pointed threateningly. You're not rid of me yet, asshole. From the back seat of the BMW, Greg stared in amazement at his pursuer now straddling the car hood. You have got to be shitting me. He didn't see that coming. He watched the man like a television show through the glass as the guy pulled an automatic pistol from his coat and aimed at the corner of the windshield. A series of muted cracks sounded. Divots appeared in the glass over a several-inch area. Greg watched this calculated attempt to penetrate his armor with something bordering on admiration. The corners were typically the weakest spots on a bulletproof windshield. It was a cool-headed call, especially with scenery racing past behind him. Too bad the glass was 3 inches of polycarbonate laminate that could stop a rifle bullet. A score of automates now surrounded Greg's BMW in close order, like a slavering pack of wolves. Greg shook his head sadly and shouted at the windshield. "What now, crazy man? You're on an armored car. What were you thinking?" Beyond the windshield, the rider suddenly brandished a killing knife as he braced himself with both feet and his other hand. Greg laughed. "Look out, he's got a knife." The rider turned, jammed the knife under the bottom edge of a satellite uplink node, and pried upward. The node peeled off with a shriek of bending metal. The voice came over the stereo system.
"Uplink 1 of 12 has failed."
Greg felt the rage building. "You son of a bitch! You're going for a ride now!" With a wave of his gloved hands, the BMW went into a power slide as the rider was nearly flung off. The major's chopper came in low and fast over the industrial area, banking so that nothing but brick factory buildings were visible in the left windows. The major clipped a monkey cord onto his harness and gave it 2 test pulls. He struggled to his feet as the chopper leveled off. The old wound in his knee was already acting up. An image of a mortar shell landing next to him in a patch of Nicaraguan mud flashed in his mind. Ancient history.
"There they are, Major," the pilot pointed.
Below, the major could see a red BMW screeching around drunkenly as it raced down the street, alternately braking and accelerating while a man tried to retain his grip on the roof. 20 more vehicles swirled around the car, moving like a single organism. More vehicles converged on the site from all directions at high speed along cross streets, smashing into the occasional unlucky motorist. People fled for their lives. He shook his head. What a goddamn mess. How had this gotten so out of control? Behind him, columns of black smoke rose here and there. "Let's give this city something else to look at," he thought. The major pulled his L3 cell phone from his jacket and spoke to the pilot as he started dialing.
"It's days like these that I almost miss working for the government."
The pilot's voice came over the closed-circuit headset. "Almost." The major laughed. The line picked up.
"Project Hazmat."
The major turned to look back through the atmospheric haze at Building 29 in the distance.
"Demolition."
A pause.
6NG73HZ6.
Another pause.
"On my mark. T-10. 9.
"We're almost there, Nat."
Ross glanced back at Building 29, 300 yards behind them now. It was burning somewhere inside, and the flaming wreckage of automates around it partially obscured it with smoke. Phillips spat out salt water.
"I think I'm really blind."
"I don't think so."
"What if that was a ZM-87 laser blinder? My retinas would be gone."
"Doesn't make sense. Why permanently blind a target you're about to hack to pieces? It's probably meant to stun victims. I'd..."
Suddenly, a wave of pressure blasted across their backs. A visible shockwave rippled through the atmosphere and pressed down around them, followed close on by a resounding boom that they felt more than heard. They both went face down in the water as the depths beneath them glowed orange and filled with the sound of splashing boulders and thousands of rock fragments. As they came up, sucking for air, rocks and small boulders were landing all around them. Their ears were ringing. Ross covered her with his body as the rocks continued to rain down. He turned to see a towering mushroom cloud roiling up from the jagged tops of Building 29's walls.
The structure was a pool of flame, with refrigerator-sized blocks of reinforced concrete still tumbling end over end across the runway. Burning debris trailing streamers of smoke sailed down from 1,000 feet overhead. Metal sheets spun crazily as they fell.
Jesus Christ! What happened? The building! It's gone!
From his perch on the BMW's roof, Merritt glanced back at a black mushroom cloud rising behind him above the factory buildings.
Son of a bitch!
Later, he thought. Suddenly, Loki accelerated the car, pulling Merritt down onto the trunk, where he stopped himself from rolling off by pushing his foot against the metal knob on the right rear corner. He grabbed onto the lip of the trunk lid.
Where the hell are the police? He thought.
He jammed the knife blade under another metal knob and tore it up from the sheet metal. The knob dangled by exposed wires until Merritt sawed through them. The voice intoned again.
Uplink 4 of 12 has failed.
Greg had 8 uplinks left. With triple redundancy, he knew he needed at least 4 to adequately control the car and his army of automates. He turned around in his seat to see the man mere inches away from his face now, still clinging on. Greg pounded the window.
That's it!
The man's motorcycle helmet clunked against the glass, awkward in its bulk as he tried to keep his center of gravity down. In between erratic car movements, the rider quickly pulled the helmet off, tossing it over his shoulder. It was immediately crushed by trailing automates. The man then pressed his head down against the trunk lid. Greg could now see the rider's face.
Roy Merritt! Holy shit!
Greg smiled in spite of himself. The famous Roy Merritt, known to every demon operative in the world. The man who tackled Sobel's home defense system and survived. The entire ordeal captured on Sobel's security cameras. The one and only Roy Merritt was hanging on to Greg's car. Greg was being pursued, and pursued damn well, by the Burning Man himself. He should have known. The son of a bitch had a knife, and he was doing more damage than a squad of corporate military. Greg couldn't deny some level of admiration. Merritt had probed Greg's defenses, found a hole, one that would be filled in the future, and improvised an exploit. What hacker couldn't admire the man's cojones, his instincts? Greg waved his hand, sending the BMW and its entire escort pack to a screeching halt. Merritt was thrown against the windshield. As the BMW lurched to a stop, Merritt stopped himself from rolling off the end of the trunk. Greg flipped his voice to the car's PA system and pounded his finger into the blacked-out glass in front of Merritt's face.
You're a fucking crazy man, Roy. You think I can't kill you the moment I get out of this car?
Merritt shook his head. You're under arrest. Greg pounded the car seat, laughing.
Woo-hoo-hoo! That's my boy. Shit, I'll make you a deal. Give me your autograph and I won't kill you.
Suddenly, Merritt's stomach exploded, splattering blood across the rear windshield. Merritt's face went slack and his eyes rolled up as his grip on the car released. Stunned, Greg watched Merritt roll off the end of the trunk and onto the pavement. Greg waved his hand and brought the BMW further down the road so he could see Merritt lying in the middle of the street. Another wave of his gloved hands and Greg cleared a ring of automates all around him. Greg looked up. A blue helicopter with a yellow logo hovered low behind them, about 100 feet off the ground. Greg looked down at Merritt, moving now, pulling himself along the center line of the road, leaving a trail of blood. Rage began to build in Greg. He looked up again at the helicopter, death in his eyes. A man wearing a black hood and holding a sniper rifle kneeled in the open doorway. He looked straight back at Greg. No demon call-out hovered above him. The major muttered under his breath.
What the hell are you waiting for, asshole?
He fired a shot at Loki's rear window, pounding a divot just next to the kid's head. but Loki barely flinched. He was looking fixedly down at Merritt, crawling across the pavement. There was a 15-foot blood trail now. Merritt was fumbling through his jacket, quivering, looking for something. The major sighed.
God damn it!
He saw two Mexican workers open a salvage yard gate to peer out at all the commotion in the street. The major gritted his teeth and turned the rifle in their direction. He squeezed off several rounds. Spouts of blood erupted from the chest of the first worker. The man pitched back into the stunned hands of his companion, who the major nailed straight between the eyes. They both fell from view. Then the major turned the crosshairs back onto Merritt. Merritt was lying on his back, panting doggedly, blood shining on his stomach, while he held two small pieces of paper before his eyes. The papers fluttered in the wind. Why wasn't Greg finishing him? Why wasn't this over yet? The pilot's voice came in over the headset. We need to go, Major. The Major made his decision. As Greg stared, suddenly, the top of Merritt's head exploded. Merritt's body slumped, twitching on the pavement.
You motherfucker!
Greg pounded his fists against the glass, staring at the sniper.
You motherfucker!
Two more divots appeared in the window as sniper bullets slammed into it. Then the chopper banked away and took off low and fast above the factory buildings, heading out over the bay. It was soon lost to sight. Greg looked back down at the body in the street. Two small photographs wafted away from Merritt's dead fingers in the wind. Ross pulled Phillips up onto the quay on the far side of the ship channel. They both crawled to level ground, and after panting for a few moments, Ross looked up. They were on the edge of a pipe storage yard. He eased Phillips up so her back rested against a smooth concrete pylon. She looked dazed. He turned to face the ruins of Building 29, burning beneath a thunderhead of roiling black smoke across the water. A dozen more columns of smoke rose elsewhere in the distance. He could hear sirens wailing all over the city. It was a war zone. Fireboats approached from the bay. He knelt down next to Phillips and brushed her wet hair away from her face.
Help is coming, Nat.
He felt her trembling.
Are you okay?
Her lips quivered slightly, but she nodded. Her face contorted, trying to contain tears.
How many do you think we lost?
He took a deep breath.
Possibly everyone.
She put a hand to her mouth and started crying.
It's not your fault, Natalie.
He put a hand on her arm reassuringly.
I was in charge.
No, you weren't. We just thought you were. She stopped and turned her blindfolded eyes toward him.
They were never going to let us stop the demon, Natalie.
You're talking crazy. The government created the task force. We were betrayed by private industry.
Private industry is your government. I thought you knew that.
How can you say that to me?
Because it's true. Sobel knew it. The demon isn't attacking us, Nat. This is a struggle between two artificial organisms. The demon is just a new species of corporation.
They sat for a moment, listening to the distant sirens.
The old social order is dissolving, Nat. It happens every few centuries.
He looked out across the burning city. Then he turned back to her.
I won't let Loki be our future.
She was trembling. Whether from being wet or scared, he couldn't tell. He brushed his hand along her cheek and eased toward her blindfolded face. His face was only an inch away from hers. She could sense him there.
I want you to know, every day, my first and last thought is of you.
He removed his hand from her cheek. She blindly glanced around, listening, feeling forward with her hands.
John.
A pause filled with the sound of sirens and approaching tug engines. She no longer felt his presence.
John.
The only reply was an echoing, amplified voice from the water.
Are you injured?
A fireboat's engines throbbed in reverse. Phillips wept on the jetty as the roar of powerful engines drowned out the world.
Chapter 45. Respawning.
Newswatch.com. Massive explosion and fire at illegal chemical dump kills 20. Alameda, California. Federal authorities are still combing through the wreckage of an unlicensed hazardous chemical dump on the site of a decommissioned military base near Oakland. A massive explosion and fire there killed 12 undocumented immigrants and injured 20 more.
He floated in the darkness of his mind for what seemed decades. Thoughts came to him only as raw concepts, black despair, vertiginous fear. As he began to coalesce from the emptiness, he slowly pieced together scraps of his personality, regaining some measure of self. His mind no longer floated on a sea of nothingness. It was enmeshed in a carnal vessel again. That vessel was named Peter Seebeck. He wasn't sure at what point he noticed someone talking. Perhaps they had been there all along. But they kept up a persistent chatter while his mind came into focus in the darkness. At first, Seebeck couldn't distinguish individual words, but as he concentrated, they became more distinct.
Christ figure is a recurring motif in many cultures. Death and rebirth, symbolic turning of the seasons, all that crap. Wile E. Coyote was a fucking Christ figure, man. And Acme Company was Rome, baby.
A pause.
You can find it in Hindu legend, Sumerian mythology, shit. You find it in modern folklore, like Rip Van Winkle. Although Rip Van Winkle didn't die, he slept. But that's the damn point. Death as sleep. Sleep as death. Isn't our life a cycle of death and rebirth? Sleep and awakening. The promise of eternal life is a threat unless you get to start over. The mythmakers knew that. They weren't dummies, man.
The clattering of metal tools.
They were the ones who invented rhyme and meter, the programming language for human memory in pre-literary civilizations. It was a cultural checksum, a mnemonic device. You couldn't fuck with the code or the rhymes didn't work. And if the rhymes didn't work, people noticed. And so the knowledge of a people was passed down intact. It was a shamanic code. If you fucked with the code, then society lost its collective mind. Smell me?
A pause.
Hey, I think our boy's coming around.
Seebeck opened his eyes and slowly focused on a pasty-faced 20-something kid sporting a tangled mane of black hair. A few days' beard shadowed the kid's neck and climbed higher than usual up his cheeks. This was a hairy guy. Seebeck blinked at the overhead lights. He coughed and tried to sit up. A rock-hard surface greeted his elbows when he tried to push up. He immediately abandoned the attempt as his head began to swim. The hairy kid leaned in close.
Hey, bro, sit back for a few. You're still trying to metabolize the meds.
Seebeck noticed the kid was wearing a lab coat. He tried to remember where he was. His brain was mashed potatoes. Seebeck's voice croaked.
Where is this?
Phoenix Mortuary Services. I call it PMS.
Seebeck tried to sit up, and he pushed aside the kid's hands when he tried to help.
Who?
He stopped short. His throat was sore as hell. He put a hand to his larynx. No exterior damage. Seebeck leaned to one side and looked around. His eyes tried to focus to a greater distance. He was in a long room with several medical examination tables. Oak cabinetry lined the walls. A strong chemical odor assaulted his nose. He'd smelled this before. Formaldehyde. Seebeck snapped alert. The body of an old man lay naked on a nearby metal table. The old man was definitely dead because his body had the pallor and flattened appearance that comes when the blood pressure and breath leave the human frame.
Where am I?
Like I said, my man, funeral home. That's where they send dead people. It's the law. And you, my friend, are legally dead. Got the paperwork to prove it.
Seebeck looked around for a few moments more, then brought his gaze back to the kid.
Who are you?
The kid wiped his hand on his lab coat and then extended it.
Laney Price, body prep. I take out the pacemakers and shit like that. That stuff will blow up if it goes in the furnace.
Seebeck ignored Price's hand and tried to shake his head clear. He glanced down, then swung his legs over the edge of the table and sat up. Price rushed to hold him steady, but Seebeck pushed him back. He glanced down at his own body. He was wearing casual slacks and a pullover shirt. Next to him on the table laid his crumpled prison khakis. He picked them up, balling them up in his fists.
That's right.
He remembered now. He had just been executed for murdering federal officers. He was the most hated man in America. He dropped the khakis and sat motionless, staring at his own hands. A wave of emotion overcame him, and he started to breathe in fits. He was alive. Price clapped a hand around his shoulders.
Hey, Sergeant, you're not dead, man. Relax.
Seebeck threw off Price's arm and grabbed him by the throat.
What the fuck is going on?
Price extricated himself as Seebeck nearly swooned from the effort.
You tell me. You brought me here.
Seebeck was still trying to clear his head. God, his throat hurt.
What are you talking about?
Look.
Price stomped off and tore a newspaper clipping from its place on a nearby bulletin board. He came back to the examining table and pointed at the clipping. A file picture of Seebeck below the headline, Seebeck's Macabre Message.
Message received, compadre.
Seebeck grabbed the article. It was months old. His head started to clear as the adrenaline kicked in. It worked. The demon had saved him. But why? Before he could ask another question, Price tossed him a plastic water bottle.
Electrolytes, better drink up.
Seebeck realized just how thirsty he was. He cracked open the water and drank deeply. His throat throbbed. Price continued.
Old One Eye's been asking for you. He's all up in my grill, and I'm like, yo, back off, Methuselah. That sprite is a screensaver from hell, I swear it, man. He's a fourth-dimensional stain.
Seebeck finished the bottle.
You want to say that again in English?
For being in charge, you seem woefully uninformed.
What do you mean, in charge?
Price threw up his hands.
See, you gotta talk to One Eye. Hang on a sec.
Price headed over to a locked cabinet, pulled out a choked keyring, and started cycling through the keys. He talked while he searched.
You know, it's an honor to finally meet you. You drew a lot of ink. Most of it said you were evil incarnate, but we all know that's horseshit. That Angie Anderson chick is out to get you, but evil or not, that bitch is fucking hot. I'd do her. Evil demon bitch. Laney likes the bad girls.
Seebeck was looking around the room again.
You were talking to someone earlier. Something about myths and rhyme.
Price paused.
You heard that?
Is someone else here?
Seebeck glanced around cautiously. Price just snickered to himself.
Yeah, bad habit from working with dead people.
He stuck a key in the lock.
They're good listeners, though. Haven't heard a complaint yet.
He rummaged around in the cabinet and came out with a sealed plastic box. Price walked back to the examining table, struggling to open the seal.
Damn things! It's the Asians that do this.
He fished around among the scalpels on his work table near the body of the old man.
You know, the average Chinese factory worker must think Americans are insane. Picture this. You work at a plant that makes Halloween stuff. You know, like rubber severed heads. And you're all like, Americans decorate their homes with severed heads? These fuckers are savages, man.
Seebeck slowly leaned forward and tried to stand. He still felt woozy. Oh, I wouldn't do that if I were you.
You're not me.
Seebeck managed to stand, still holding the table to steady himself.
So you say I created this place?
He glanced around.
By sending that message to the demon?
Price got the box open.
All will become clear, young grasshopper, when you talk to One-Eye. And then maybe he'll get off my ass.
Price pulled an intricate and expensive-looking pair of sports sunglasses from the box. It was sealed in yet another plastic bag.
Why did they do this shit?
He started biting into the plastic and twisting.
One-Eye?
Price gave him a look.
Do you have several one-eyed undead freaks stalking you, Sergeant? Should I be more specific?
Sobel, Seebeck thought.
Price now pulled the glasses out of the bag. They were stylish, with yellow-tinted lenses and hip frames, but the posts were unusually thick. Price also pulled a thick, belt-like device from the box. He glanced at Seebeck and started adjusting a strap.
Just take me a sec. You're what, size 38?
34.
Damn, I gotta lose about 40 pounds myself. But then again, you were on the,
air quotes here,
Lompoc prison diet.
Seebeck just pointed at the glasses.
Oh, HUD, heads up display. It's an interface to the demon network. Check this shit out.
The demon network?
Can't see T.O.P. without the H.U.D.
Stop with the acronyms.
I've got acronyms for my acronyms.
He held up the belt and clicked a battery into place.
Ready? Here, put this on.
He handed it to Seebeck. Seebeck took it warily. It was like a thick money belt and was made of black, stretchable, nylon-like material with a sleek titanium buckle. Price was fiddling with the glasses.
The belt's a combination satellite phone, GPS, and wearable computer. Methane oxide fuel cell battery will last for about 3 days. Works in conjunction with the glasses. Be careful with it. It's ruggedized and water resistant, but don't go driving nails with it. The glasses alone cost about $50,000.
Seebeck was taken aback.
What are you joking? Who paid for them?
Demons got cash, bro. Hell, you ain't seen nothing.
Why is it giving them to me? I want to destroy the demon.
Because it wants to have a word with you.
Seebeck considered this for a few moments. Then he fastened the belt around his waist. It fit well and felt like a lifting belt. Price slid the HUD glasses onto Seebeck's face. Seebeck wrapped the band around his head.
Nice fit.
Should be a perfect fit. They scanned your head.
They? Who's they?
Price shrugged.
Fabricators, micro-manufacturers, hell, who knows? The demon shipped it to me.
Seebeck noticed the lens flicker momentarily, then returned to normal.
It's got a retinal scanner and a heart pulse sensor. If you're a member of the network and still alive, it knows who you are and what your rights are. It senses the moment you take them off. Put them on, you just logged on. Take them off, you just logged off.
Price walked briskly over to a cluttered desk nearby.
Wait a sec.
He grabbed another pair of glasses sitting there and put them on. They looked at each other. Suddenly, Seebeck's lenses blinked. Then information appeared at the top and bottom of the screen. He focused on Price and was surprised to see a name call-out box hovering over Price, just like in the game The Gate. Price's screen name was apparently Chunky Monkey.
You gotta be shitting me.
No, man, check this out.
He pointed at Seebeck's glasses.
See the green bar stack next to my name? That's my network power relative to you. That number 7? That's my skill level.
Price appeared to have 7 bars.
Network power?
It's a point system. I see no bars, that means you're a wuss compared to me. How many bars do you see?
7.
That means I'm nominally 7 times as powerful as you. It has to do with the shamanic interface, but we'll cover that later. Right now, we gotta see One-Eye before he goes into a loop.
He must know you're awake by now since you just logged on.
Seebeck was having difficulty absorbing the reality of it all.
Price approached him. Here.
He adjusted one side of the glasses, lowering a short piece of metal.
Sound boom. Gives you audio by vibrating the bones in your head. Works as a microphone the same way.
Price motioned for Seebeck to hurry.
You good to walk or should I get a wheelchair?
Price came up alongside and helped to steady him.
This way.
Price brought them toward an alcove in which was set a pair of imposing oak doors about 9 feet tall. Seebeck still felt dizzy, and the glasses weren't helping. Inexplicable information kept flashing and winking at him.
God, it's like walking with sports scores flashing before my eyes.
Never mind that. You can customize it later. If you want to see without the glasses, flip the lenses up. They're on a hinge. Don't take the glasses off or you'll log off the system, and it'll take a few seconds to get logged back on. You'll get used to it.
They reached the door. Price motioned for Seebeck to stay put, then grabbed the door handles. He glanced back.
Sergeant, welcome to the Demon's Darknet.
He opened the doors. They swung inward, revealing a plushly appointed but rather stodgy office with stuffed leather chairs and thick carven furniture. It looked like the office of an 18th century natural philosopher. Bookcases and curio cabinets filled with insect and rock specimens lined the windowless walls. There was dust everywhere. But what riveted Seebeck's gaze was the translucent apparition of Matthew Sobel sitting behind the big mahogany desk, hands folded as if waiting patiently. It was a post-surgery Sobel with his open eye socket, hollow cheeks, and bald head. A shriveled wreckage of a man ravaged by chemotherapy and cancer. He was wearing the same suit he wore at his funeral. His specter nodded in somber greeting.
Detective Seebeck, I've been waiting for you.
He motioned for Seebeck to come forward.
Please, have a seat.
Seebeck looked to Price. Price nodded in commiseration.
I know, it's freaky, but don't worry, you're not Hamlet. This is a temporal offset projection, Sergeant. It's an interactive 3D avatar projected over the GPS grid. It's only visible and audible in your HUD glasses.
Seebeck studied the specter. He flipped up his glass lenses. Sobel disappeared. He flipped them back down again, and Sobel's specter returned.
It's a private dimension.
Actually, it's a dynamic array capable of encapsulating a variable number of dimensional elements.
Seebeck looked at him blankly. Price patted him on the back.
You're right. It's a private dimension.
He made a scooting motion.
Better sit down. He'll know if you don't do it.
Seebeck stepped forward and sat in one of the stuffed leather chairs. He wiped a thin layer of dust from the armrests and shifted to keep the computer belt from pressing into his back. Seebeck could actually see Sobel more clearly now, since he was closer. Sobel's phantasm was gaunt, and the gaping eye socket looked horrific. He really did resemble a restless spirit wandering the earth. Sobel looked toward Price.
Leave us.
Damn!
Price looked to Seebeck.
You're on your own, my man. I gotta leave.
Seebeck gestured to the apparition of Sobel.
What the hell do I say to this thing?
I was hoping you'd know.
Price rushed out, closing the double doors behind him. Sobel's specter gazed at the doors. A loud click sounded as they locked. After a few moments, Sobel turned again to Seebeck. He smiled slightly.
I'm glad it was you, Sergeant. You were my favorite. So damaged by your choices. You never understood games. Maybe that's why the world was such a mystery to you.
Seebeck stared.
Why don't you just die already?
Sobel paused.
Mammals of every species indulge in play. Games are nature's way of preparing us to face difficult realities. Are you finally ready to face reality, Sergeant?
Kiss my ass.
Sobel's specter pointed at his own forehead.
It's so clear here. even if you can't see it.
He lowered his arm.
Civilization is about to fail.
Seebeck felt a wave of anxiety wash over him.
Christ, he thought.
The modern world is a highly efficient precision machine, but that's its flaw. One wrench in the works, and it all grinds to a halt. So what does our generation get? A culture of lies to hide weakness, decreasing freedom, all to conceal one simple fact. The assumptions upon which our civilization is based are no longer valid. If you doubt me, ask yourself, why was I able to accomplish this?
Seebeck shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
But what if we corrected civilization's weakness, as painful as that correction might be?
Sobel changed expression, looking more relaxed.
But you're probably confused. Why did I frame you? It's simple. You were bait. Bait that they took. The weak hide their weakness. By now, the plutocrats have put their money in safer havens, and I have closely watched this transfer. Now, they are more vulnerable than ever.
Sobel grinned humorlessly.
You were my Trojan horse, Sergeant.
Seebeck's fingernails nearly tore through the chair leather.
Fuck you! You destroyed my life!
Sobel's specter flickered almost imperceptibly.
An analysis of your voice patterns is revealing. Prosody tells me that you are agitated. Save your anger, detective. It will make no difference to the outcome.
Seebeck ground his teeth.
Who will mourn for you, Sergeant? No one. You and I share that. We have sacrificed for the greater good. In gratitude, I cared for your family in your absence, when no one else would. Your family has no idea that I am their benefactor.
Seebeck leaned forward, another rage building.
What have you done?
Sobel continued.
They will continue to have good fortune, but only as long as I can count on you, detective.
You son of a bitch!
Seebeck swept a curio case off Sobel's desk, sending it crashing into the wall behind him. Glass shards flew everywhere.
Don't involve my family!
Sobel's specter flickered again.
There is that pattern again. You're upset. I defer to your judgment in this matter. Answer yes or no. Should the demon withdraw support from your family?
Seebeck stopped short. He took a breath and realized he had no idea how to respond.
Respond yes or no, or I will make a random choice for you.
Damn you!
Answer now. Do you want the demon to withdraw financial support from your family?
Seebeck shook his head and closed his eyes.
No.
Thank you. The demon will continue to provide for them. Now, please sit down.
I hope you're burning in hell.
Seebeck sat.
We both know you don't believe in hell.
Seebeck sat stunned at the specter's response.
Yes, I've done quite a bit of research on you, Sergeant. But don't confuse me with someone who gives a damn about you. You will live or die, and I don't care which. The only thing I care about is the demon's goal. There's a greater good in this than you can understand, perhaps than you'll ever understand. Since you were clever enough to save yourself, you may be of some use to me still. If the demon triumphs, tens of millions will die. If it fails, billions will die, and we will fall back to a 17th century agrarian economy. Those are the stakes, Sergeant.
Seebeck was practically climbing out of his skin. He whispered under his breath,
God damn you.
You want to destroy the demon, but you offer nothing in its place. How can you expect to handle the future if you can't even handle the present? I'll tell you what the demon is. The demon is a remorseless system for building a distributed civilization. A civilization that perpetually regenerates. One with no central authority. Your only option is what form that civilization takes, and that depends on the actions of people like you.
Sobel stood and started pacing behind the desk. For the first time, Seebeck noticed that the desk chair was also a phantasm. There was no real chair behind the desk.
There are those who resist necessary change. Even now, they think only of protecting their investments. I am at war with them, a war that you'll never see on the evening news. And to my mind, the outcome of this war will decide whether civilization flourishes or collapses into a thousand-year dark age. Perhaps, even with the eclipse of the human race as the dominant species on this planet. Sobel ran his hand along the scar on his skull. My enemies will show themselves soon, Sergeant. As much as you despise me, they are your true enemy. I am merely an inevitable consequence of human progress, an unfeeling, unthinking thing.
Seebeck sat in stunned silence for several moments. Sobel's specter sat on the edge of the desk near Seebeck.
I suspect that democracy is not viable in a technologically advanced society. Free people wield too much ability to destroy. But I will give you the chance to determine the truth of this. If you fail to prove the viability of democracy in man's future, then humans will serve society, not the other way around. Either way, a change is coming. I see it, as plainly as I see you sitting there.
Seebeck realized Sobel had indeed envisioned this moment, for here Seebeck sat.
Do you accept the task of finding justification for the freedom of humanity, Sergeant? Yes or no?
Seebeck sat staring at the floor. He missed his family. He was tired of being alone, of feeling the hatred of the world seeping through the walls of every room he was in. Why was this happening to him? Why did it have to be him?
Do you accept this task, Sergeant? Yes or no?
Son of a bitch, he thought.
I will ask one more time. Will you?
Yes.
Sobel's specter flickered briefly, then nodded.
Good, Sergeant. I'm glad you could overcome your hatred of me.
Sobel stood and walked toward the wall. His steps creaked on the floor to complete the illusion. He turned toward Seebeck.
Walk with me.
With a wave of the specter's hand, a section of the wall opened in reality, revealing a narrow back hallway. Wainscoting and rich wallpaper lined the walls. Seebeck rose reluctantly, glancing back at the sealed double doors he'd entered through, then looked again at Sobel's phantom padding down the hall. Sobel turned back again to look over his shoulder.
Please, Sergeant.
Seebeck gritted his teeth and followed on Sobel's heels as the apparition opened another door at the end of the hallway. Brilliant sunlight and a mild, fresh breeze filled the hall. The sound of rustling leaves came in on the wind. Seebeck stopped. It had been many months since he'd been outside. His nostrils flared, taking in the fragrance. Balmy air whirled around him. Sobel's specter beckoned him. Seebeck strode down a short series of steps and into the sunlight. He hurried to catch up with Sobel, who was already moving across a green stretch of lawn beneath the shade of an ancient California oak. They were in a low-walled yard at the back of a great Victorian mansion. Seebeck turned on his heels, drinking in the sun and the scenery. The Lompoc Valley lay around him. Rolling grassy hills dotted with oaks, blue mountains loomed on the horizon. Split-rail fences undulated over the contours of the land. The wind waved through the grass. The beauty of it almost brought Seebeck to tears. He was alive. Sobel stood next to the great oak, looking down at the ground. Seebeck moved to catch up, and as he reached the tree, he could see a small headstone there, set in the grass near the low wall. Seebeck read the simple inscription, Matthew Sobel, 1969. The inscription was centered,
leaving no room for a date of death. Sobel's specter gazed out over the valley below.
I loved this place.
He turned to Seebeck.
Are you familiar with the Fates, Sergeant? Greek legend said that they spun the threads of men's lives and cut them at a length of their choosing. Like the Fates, I severed the thread of your life.
Sobel faced toward the horizon and extended his hand. Suddenly, a glowing blue line appeared in D-space, extending from Sobel's palm and tracing almost instantly down the nearby road and through the hills, to be lost beyond the horizon.
Here is your new thread. Only you can see it, and it leads to a future only you can find.
At that, Sobel's ghostly image turned and started descending slowly into the ground of his grave, as if walking down ethereal steps. He moved methodically, slowly, like a monk in procession. Just before Sobel's head disappeared beneath the soil, he stopped and looked up directly into Seebeck's eyes.
The guardian of this node will teach you all you need to know. When you leave this place, Sergeant, remember that they killed Peter Seebeck once. Do not doubt that they will kill him again if he reappears. Alive, you're a grave risk to their world. Such is your fate.
With one last glance, Sobel stepped down into his grave and disappeared beneath the grass. Seebeck stared for several minutes at the spot where his nemesis had disappeared. His thoughts were turbulent, not yet forming into anything definite. Why didn't he feel rage, depression? He finally looked up, and the thread was still there, undulating over the land, projected from where Seebeck stood. He flipped up the HUD glass lenses, and the glowing thread disappeared. He flipped them down, and the line returned. Seebeck heard the crunch of gravel, and he turned to see a black Lincoln Town Car easing to a stop just beyond the back wall gate. Laney Price got out and moved to open the rear car door. He motioned dramatically for Seebeck to get inside. With one last glance at Sobel's grave, Seebeck approached the car, pushing open the wrought iron gate. Price nodded, still holding open the rear door.
I'm supposed to help you, Sergeant. Sobel said you'd know where to go.
Seebeck gazed back along the road behind them, away from the blue thread. He thought of his previous life, of those he'd left behind, of the sheriff's department, Laura, and his son, Chris, of everyone and everything he'd ever known. Peter Seebeck was dead. He turned to face the blue line again, tracing a glowing filament down the road and toward a distant horizon.
I'll drive.
This is Jeff Gerner. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Demon by Daniel Suarez. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Demon is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2009, all rights reserved. The book Demon is available wherever Dutton books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.